And welcome back to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. KUCI is proudly broadcasting from studios at the University of California, Irvine. And we are going to be pleased to have in a few minutes Dr. John Lewis from Ashland University in Ohio. He's going to be talking about the failure of Homeland Defense. He's also giving a free talk tomorrow evening here in Irvine. So if this free talk tomorrow evening is going to be at the Hyatt Regency Irvine and on Jamboree Road, that's 17,900 Jamboree Road here in Irvine. The talk is at 7:30 tomorrow night. So I guess the bookstore is being put on by the Ayn Rand Institute. Their bookstore is going to open at 6:30. The presentation will be 1 hour from 7:30 to 8:30 p.m., and then from 8:30 to 9:30 he will take questions. But you also have a chance to talk to Dr. Lewis this morning. He will be here on KUCI 88.9 FM in about 4 minutes. And the number to call him here will be 949-UCI-KUCI. That's 949-824-5824. And I would like to invite everybody to listen next week. When next week, Weekly Signals, we're going to give our time out for Weekly Signals next week, and they will have a two-hour special. And so they will be on from 8 to 10 a.m. next Tuesday, March 29th. And their guests will be John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, America's favorite political activist and host of Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman. And they'll also have their good friend, the director of Progressive Democrats of America and America's second favorite political activist, Tim Carpenter. Thanks. I know that they'll do a great job with that next week. And I would like to invite you just to listen to these important messages, and we will be back on in about 3 minutes with Dr. John Lewis to talk about the failure of Homeland Defense. He is a scholar of classical history, a professor at Ashland University in Ohio, and I know he's going to have some interesting things to say. Definitely he's going to have some provocative things to say. So I'd like you to come here, and I'd also like to encourage you to go to his free talk tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m. at the Hyatt Regency Irvine on Jamboree Road. That's 17,900 Jamboree Road in Irvine, and his talk will start at 7:30 p.m. The talk is free. Parking is $5 or $9 for valet parking. So please listen to these important announcements, and we will be back in about 2 minutes with Dr. John Lewis to talk about the failure of Homeland Defense, lessons from history.
For a fresh alternative to your talk show routine, tune in to KUCI 88.9 FM for the best in local public affairs programming in Orange County. And if you're behind a computer, listen online at www.kuci.org. KUCI, commercial-free programming since 1969.
This is Ralph Cicerone, Chancellor here at the University of California at Irvine. When I have to catch up on what's next in the world of music, I always turn to KUCI, broadcasting proudly at 88.9 FM and over the internet at kuci.org.
Some thoughts from John Cleese.
A hotel in Miami is called Hawaii. There is also a motel in Hawaii called Miami. The place that seems romantic and special is always somewhere else. Those who grow oranges in their backyards love apple orchards. Those with an apple tree or two dream of oranges. What seems most desirable is always the thing we don't have. If we could only see our homes and possessions the way others see them, perhaps we would no longer take them for granted. We could then realize that it matters little whether we live in Miami or Hawaii. Each place is beautiful in its own right.
A message from the philosophers of America, celebrating 100 years of thought.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
UC Irvine Extension offers a one-day course with Lisa Firestone and Joyce Catlett, which addresses the issues and ways couples can learn to communicate meaningfully with each other based on identifying and challenging negative thoughts towards themselves and their partners. The course will also feature powerful video examples and role-play opportunities.
Honey, why don't you talk to me anymore?
I love you, but it is just so hard for me to show it because I have to learn to love myself. Before I can love anybody else, you understand, honey, I love you, but I fear
intimacy. I'm Jack Johnson, heavyweight champion of the world. I'm black, they never let me forget it. I'm black, all right. I'll never let them forget it.
Fear of Intimacy, an innovative approach to couples therapy, will be offered on Saturday, April 2nd, 2005, from 8:30 to 4:30 p.m. at the UCI campus, Extension Building H, rooms 160 and 161. To register online, please visit www.extension.uci.edu or call 949-824-5414.
And good morning, and welcome to Campus Talk UCI here on KUCI 88.9 FM. We are joined on the phone by Dr. John Lewis. Dr. Lewis, are you with us?
I'm with you. How are you?
Super. It's great to hear from you, and thank you so much for doing our radio show this morning. First, can you tell us a little bit about, you're a professor at Ashland University in Ohio, right?
I'm a professor at Ashland University in Ohio, where we're waiting for the spring weather to come.
Really?
Yes, we are. I'm looking forward to a nice sunny time in Southern California.
Oh, that's right. You're giving a talk, and let me just remind the listeners that that you're giving a talk tomorrow night for the Ayn Rand Institute is bringing you out here to give a talk, The Failure of Homeland Defense, The Lessons from History. That's 9:30 tomorrow night, Wednesday the 23rd, at the Hyatt Regency Irvine, which is at 17,900 Jamboree Road here in Irvine.
Except I believe it's 7:30.
What did I say?
You said 9:30.
Oh, no, 7:30. It's going to be over at 9:30. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it'll be over at 9:30. Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. Okay. One-hour talk followed by question and answer where you may stand forth and give me your best shot.
Okay. What kind of work do you do at the University of Ashland?
Well, I'm a professor of history. Now, my background is in classics, so my specialty is in ancient Greece and Rome. But I've taken myself out of Greece and Rome into the implications of classical culture for the modern day, including especially into warfare. And I'm very concerned with, parallels in history between the experiences of the Greeks and the Romans and the modern day. I teach a variety of courses. We have our standard Western civilization courses that go from the Stone Age, into the modern day, but also special courses in Greece, in Rome, in warfare, and in the Renaissance.
What are the main lessons that the ancients can teach us about war and peace?
Well, one of the interesting things is that the nature of a basic attitude toward an aggressor. When the Greeks faced aggression from abroad, whether it was from another nation, from another city like their own, or from a foreign power such as the Persians, they recognized the need to get the fight off of their own land. They recognized the folly of backing up into their own city and trying to adopt a defensive position and trying to beat their enemy that way. They recognized that you had to take the fight. If you're the victim of aggression, if someone else is aggressing against you, you've got to fight for your own self-interest and take the fight to the enemy. The Greeks were not, tainted by the idea that the goal of the war is to somehow do good for other people. As far as they were concerned, the goal of the war was to win, and the same for the Romans. And this is a powerful lesson for us today.
Is this something? Now, I know that when we fought World War II, the ultimate goal was the unconditional surrender of the enemy. But isn't that, in the current political situation in the world, isn't that kind of naive? Isn't that not possible now?
Well, you could have made that argument back then. Japan was a very powerful power. It was a power that had attacked Manchuria and China. It had an empire in the Pacific. At the start of the war, it was far stronger in the Pacific than we were. And you could very easily have said back then, well, the overthrow of Japan, that's a pipe dream. That's naive. We'll never do that. Maybe what we should do is negotiate with the Japanese. Carve out a sphere of influence for them. Maybe we should, establish democracy in Australia so it can be an example to them. How could we overthrow Japan? They're so strong. But in fact, we did, because we bent ourselves to that end, to that goal, and drove forth to accomplish it. And in fact, today, the discrepancy in power between the United States and, let's say, any of the nations in the Middle East, or even the Middle East as a whole, is greatly on our side. It would be more naive to think it was possible back then than to think that is possible now.
Well, let's talk about what we should be doing in the Middle East now. Let me ask, first, what would the proper response be? How should we have responded to the attacks of September 11, 2001?
Well, the first thing comes down to our basic attitude toward those attacks and what we should do about them. I'm not a military strategist, so I would not sit and presume to say that we should attack this country or that country in this way or in that way. But what I do observe is the basic attitude toward those attacks. And the basic attitude should have been, first off, that our government's reason for being, its proper response, and the reason why we have a government, is to protect us from foreign aggression. And therefore, we should be out to end the states, overthrow the governments who threaten us, as not for the purpose of doing good for the people under those governments, but for the purpose of self-protection. So in other words, I start from the idea of self-interest. We need to approach the war with our own self-interest in mind, not with the goal of doing good for other people as a primary.
Isn't there a problem, though, because since the attack was carried out by largely a stateless group, by these terrorists, why if the response, and I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, so I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here.
No, very good.
If the response was carried out by this terrorist group that were not affiliated with any state, they didn't fly, unlike the Japanese who bombed Pearl Harbor, they weren't attacking us with their national flags flying. Can we really go after a government when these people seem to be stateless and they seem to be, you know, beyond the control of any particular state?
Sure, that's a good question, and a very fair question, and a proper question. The fact is that every one of these groups can exist only with the support of certain governments. Governments control every square inch of Earth on the planet. Every one of these groups is operating out of some area controlled by a government.
Is that really true? This isn't like the government of Afghanistan. Isn't some governments weak and that don't really control their own territory very well? Aren't there governments like that in the world?
Oh, sure. There is some of that. But, you know, look what has happened, you know, with Afghanistan. Once that government is overthrown and the people are establishing some kind of a rational government in the area, you know, the base for terrorism has been eliminated there. Now, I know they're still hiding in the hills and there's still some areas of Pakistan where the Pakistani government doesn't dare go. But those groups are basically, you know, weak and don't have the kind of resources to carry out international attacks if those bases have been eliminated from them. You know, for example, you know, the Hezbollah group is a group that's often brought up this way. Aren't they stateless? Aren't they simply, you know, a subgroup, you know, within Lebanon, let's say, and within Syria? But the Hezbollah groups were all established by Iran. In the 1970s, before Khomeini even came to power, he established these Hezbollah, which is Party of God groups, in Syria with the support of the Syrian dictator Assad, in Lebanon, in Iran, and in various other nations with the idea of creating this world movement. This movement all still depended upon direct support from the Iranian government. In fact, I would argue that the Syrian government itself would fall immediately if Iranian support was taken away and they were forced out of Lebanon. So again, there's a certain source to all of this, these attacks on us that does rest back, a certain material, ideological, and political support that does rest back with these governments.
Well, one government that had been supporting terrorism was the government of Iraq. Would you agree with me about that?
I would agree that they're supporting terrorism, but they were certainly not the source of it. They were certainly not the center of it.
So was the response to after Afghanistan? First, did you think the Afghanistan was a good first place to attack, and do you think Bush did the right thing in going after the Taliban?
Well, I think he did a good thing in going after them. They certainly deserved it, and they certainly fell like a matchstick very, very quickly. But it was certainly not the only reason for going to Afghanistan would be that you need to go there en route to the real source, which is Iran. Attacking Afghanistan and stopping there would be like us attacking North Africa in World War II and then stopping there. We had to go through North Africa in order to get to Sicily and Italy, which was necessary in order to get to Germany. But we didn't stop at Italy, let's say, in World War II, decide that what we have to do is establish a democratic government as an alternative for the Germans to see, etc. If we had done that, we'd still be in Italy trying to pacify the country.
Sure.
What these other nations, such as Afghanistan, who definitely deserved it, there was definitely justification for going after them. There was some justification for going after Iraq, but neither one of them is the primary base of support for this. That base of support is Iran. And once that was overthrown, then a message had to go to the Saudis, that they had to stop this constant support of ideologically undermining and inculcating this hatred of the West within the minds of their youth. And the best message, the best way to get all of that done starts with the overthrow of Iran.
So do you think we should have, instead of going after Iraq, do you think we should have attacked Iran?
Yes, I would maintain that the only reason for going after Iraq is if we need to protect our rear on the way to Tehran.
And so are you advocating war with Iran now?
I would advocate the immediate overthrow of the government in Iran at this point. Now, I'm not sure what the best tactic to go about doing that is. I personally think the whole thing could be done with a series of airstrikes that wouldn't involve the loss of any American life.
You really think so? I mean, are there...
But I do. But the problem is that Bush has let the Iranian situation fester for so long that every day it gets harder and harder to do that. They're building more and more hardened underground bunkers. You know, and it's been allowed to fester for so long that it's much harder now than it needed to be.
Yeah, let me ask you. You talked about Bush, and on your website. You, by the way, Dr. Lewis also writes for Capitalism Magazine, and so they are. You can find some of his articles at www.capmag.com, and you can also find it at your website. Why don't you give the listeners your website?
Oh yes, I'm at the Ashland University, so it's www.ashland.edu. And then you have to get to me, which is / then tilde, which is that little squiggle mark, JLewis8.
Okay.
So it's www.ashland.edu/tilde JLewis8.
And if you're driving, don't write all that down. We'll put a link up on the schedule for this show at KUCI.org.
Thanks. And of course, you can just go to www.ashland.edu and look for me under the faculty, too.
Okay, that works also. We'll put it on KUCI.org. Click on Tuesday morning, 9 a.m., and then scroll down to today's date, and we'll have a link up there by the end of the day today.
Thanks.
And, okay, so how is President Bush doing, and how is he doing also considering the political realities that he faces here in the United States?
Well, first off, I don't think President Bush has ever really grasped the fact that the American people would support him in a forthright defense of America. In the days following 9/11, the United States people were, you know, united behind him to do this. But the United States people also recognize that what has been done in Iraq is not at all a forthright defense of American interests. Look, it's Operation Iraqi Freedom. It's us doing good for the Iraqis by bringing freedom to them, freedom which I'm not at all certain yet they really understand or really want. Maybe they do. I hope they do.
Certainly they don't seem to appreciate it. I mean, seeming that from what I'm hearing from them, even though I think they're glad to have Saddam gone, I haven't heard any signs of gratitude from the Iraqis.
They're not doing, if they wanted to end the insurgency, they would start turning the insurgents over to us, and that's not really happening. There was some words I heard from an American sergeant who went into a neighborhood, and he said as soon as he started to walk into the neighborhood, he saw the local people scattering. And as soon as he saw that, he said he realized they were walking into an ambush. Because whenever these ambushes are set up, all the locals know.
Mm-hmm.
So none of the locals ran forward and said, you know, be careful of the building on the left. They ran away because at best, they're waiting to see who will win. It's important to note that probably, I'm not an expert on Iraqi culture, but I would guess that 75% of the people in Iraq really just want to know who's going to win. If the insurgents and the Islamists are going to win, then the masses of the population don't want to be seen as their enemies. If the United States is going to pull out and leave them to them, and as we've done too many times in the past, then they want to be on the winning side. So the important thing to do is to go there and to win. So, for example, when we were driving up through Iraq, the first time any of these people, the insurgents or these our enemies, backed into a mosque and started shooting at us, an airstrike should have been called in. It should have leveled that mosque and a square mile around it. And then we could have told them that you will not get immunity if you back into a mosque. If you want to preserve your mosque as a house of God, don't shoot at us from it. And that's the kind of demonstration that would be necessary to bring peace to Iraq, even if it wasn't our interest to do so.
Well, you say that would bring peace there, but I mean, I guess the administration worried that doing something like that would just get them that much madder at us.
Oh, that's all a theory, and that is not the way it follows. You notice that, for example, in the Palestinians versus the Israelis, every time the Israelis have made a peace offer to the Palestinians have reacted by calling another intifada. And every time the Israelis have built a fence and started cracking down, the attacks have slowed up. the attacks have slowed up greatly recently because of this intransigent attitude by the Israelis and their building of the fence. Now, the Israelis are getting set to pull out of the Gaza Strip, pull out of other areas. They pull out of Gaza, and they're going to pull out of other areas and turn them over to the Palestinians. It is unfortunate, but I think you're going to see the attacks start up again.
The attacks are so you're saying Israel is making a mistake to withdraw from these areas unilaterally?
I think that they are, and I think that the fundamental error is this. And the fundamental error is to think that if we attack and win, therefore we embolden the enemy. It's exactly the opposite. When you retreat, you embolden the enemy, or when you refuse to meet them head on, you embolden the enemy because you give them the hope and the expectation that they can win. If you defeat them, then you defeat them. Now, in other words, suppose you took that idea that defeating the enemy creates more enemy, and you applied it to Japan in World War II. I mean, we atom-bombed two cities in Japan. There should have been a massive uprising against the Americans by the Japanese that would have gone on for 20 years. Instead, there wasn't. They surrendered. They gave up. We wrote a constitution for them. We didn't ask them what they wanted. We wrote the constitution for them. And the result has been permanent peace in Japan and a permanent ally in Japan. So it works exactly the opposite. Defeating an enemy does not embolden them. It defeats them and makes possible the conditions for peace.
Okay, we are talking with John Lewis, who is going to be giving a talk tomorrow night here in Irvine. The talk is called The Failure of Homeland Defense, The Lessons from History. This is going to be at 7:30 p.m. tonight at the Hyatt Regency Irvine on Jamboree. The talk is free. Parking is $5 or $9 for valet parking. And it's being put on by the Ayn Rand Institute. And you can go to, for information, you can go to their website, which is just aynrand.org. That's AYNRAND.org. So, Doctor, let me also invite any listeners, if you'd like to ask Dr. Lewis a question, the number is 949-824-5824. That number is UCI, KUCI, in the 949 area code. So, Dr. Lewis, your talk tomorrow night is The Failure of Homeland Defense. So what is the failure? We've been talking a little bit about Iraq and the situation over there, but Homeland Defense primarily concerns with what we do here in America.
Correct.
What is the failure of Homeland Defense?
Well, the failure is this. I undertook a study about a year or so ago, year and a half ago, to look at multiple examples in history, going back to the Greeks and even before, and to examine a situation in which a nation has come under attack. A nation which is capable of defending itself has come under attack. And what is their basic attitude toward the enemy? And I wanted examples where they at first retreated and adopted a defensive position and then adopted an offensive attitude and to see what the results were. And I look at several examples in ancient Greece. I look at Rome's rise. I look at Rome's fall. I look at the medieval period. I look at Sherman's march through the south. I look at the rise of World War II, the start of World War II. And in every case, what I've found is that a defensive attitude, an attitude of backing up and building walls and being nice by not attacking the enemy's capital, has resulted in prolonged conflict, longer and longer warfare with higher and higher casualties. And that the only way you end a war and end it quickly and end the casualties is by driving into the enemy's homeland and defeating him on his own soil. And that's my basic thesis. What my talk tomorrow night does is condense. It just takes a couple of examples from this book. No attempt to try to do all of them. Just to take a couple of examples from that book, illustrate the basic thesis, and then suggest and draw the conclusion that that is what we should be doing today.
Okay, is this your book?
Yes, it's not. It's not yet out. It's in manuscript form, and I'm still working on it.
Okay, I hope you'll come back and we're not done yet, but I hope you'll come back and when you finish your book, come back on KUCI and talk about that.
Oh, I'll keep it in mind. I'll be in touch with you. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So we have this the problem that you say we should go to the enemy's capitals, and so are you arguing that the enemy capital that we need to go after is Tehran?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I put it this way. Someone once asked me in a class what would be a proper memorial to 9/11, and I wanted to make this point. And I said a proper memorial to 9/11 would be a gaping hole where Tehran used to be. And yes, I think we have to go after that. I think there's a fundamental alternative we're facing. One is to build a fortress America, which is what we're doing. It's to institutionalize you know, guards with machine guns at the Super Bowl, F-16 fighters flying over Boston, military defenses around Boston, New York, and Washington, which is what happened all through the campaign, especially during the political when the party's conventions, is to institutionalize all this. It's to get the American people used to the fact that when you get on a train, you've got to show an ID and prove you're not a terrorist. You know, and that this is the equivalent of building walls around America. And it is a futile policy because you can't stop everyone trying to come in. One success in getting past these defenses in the present day can result in a Holocaust. It's a futile policy. And more than that, it is fatal. It is fatal to what it means to be a free American. It takes our free and open cities and turns them into basically military fortresses. And I maintain that instead of doing that, we should be directing our power out at the source of this overseas.
Okay. Let me ask you the big question is, because we've talked a little bit about what you think were some of the missed opportunities that the Bush administration made after 9/11.
Yes.
But here's the big question. What do we do now?
Well, what do we do now is we have to hold in context that the basic principle has not changed. Of course, it becomes hard. You every day that we delay and follow the wrong path makes the degree of demonstration necessary much, much worse.
So
this has to be a policy, not just dropping a bomb on one city overseas. I don't want to simplify it. It has to be a policy of adopting our own self-interest first, identifying our own self-interest with freedom, and inviting coalitions from willing people who agree with freedom, but not seeking, allies among those who do not.
These are all nice principles, but I'm asking you to be a little more specific.
Sure.
Should we stay the course? Should we continue the occupation of Iraq? Continue having our troops there? I guess the occupation is officially over, but we've still got our troops there.
No, we should continue in Iraq to do what we said we would do. We should go after the insurgency very strongly. If they are operating out of a certain city, we should surround that city and demand that the insurgency end. And most of all, we should recognize that a lot of this insurgency is fueled by outside help from Syria, which means basically out of Iran. We should recognize that there will never be peace in Iraq as long as the government of Iran exists as it is, for the same reason that there wouldn't be peace in Italy in 1944 as long as Germany exists. So we need to stay the course in Iraq, but we need to recognize that the basic of that course, the fundamental, is to eliminate the support for the insurgency, and that means eliminating the governments of Syria and Iran.
Now,
and that's what we should do.
Okay, so if we're going to eliminate those governments, let me ask you the straight out thing. You seem to be kind of shy about calling for a direct attack, to attack those governments the way we did with Iraq. Are you saying that we should support the internal opposition to those governments?
Well, certainly we should be supporting the internal opposition. You know, we bombed this MEK group, which was the largest organized opposition to the Iranians. We bombed them during the Gulf War because the Iranians asked us to. Now, that's the equivalent of bombing the French resistance in World War II because Hitler asked us to.
I'm sorry.
We need to stop this nonsense.
Can you explain the situation? Because I'm sorry, I haven't heard about this, and I'm guessing that most Americans haven't either. Can you explain this incident that you just talked about?
Yes, this MEK group is not necessarily, you know, great friends of the United States, but they are an internal opposition group opposing the theocracy in Iran. And they had established bases inside Iraq, out of which they were operating against the Iranian government. During the Iraq War, the Iranians asked the United States...
And this was the first Gulf War?
No, this is the second Gulf War.
This is the current one.
The one that's continuing now, when this war first started.
Gotcha, okay.
The Iranians actually asked the United States to put this opposition group on the list of terrorists, on the terrorist list. And the United States put this group on the State Department's terrorist list, and then actually bombed one of their locations in southeastern Iraq during the war. This is entirely the wrong message, and the United States should declare openly its support for internal opposition to the theocracy in Iran.
Well, if we do that, isn't that the kiss of death? If we declare our support for our opposition, doesn't that make it that much easier for the Iranians to say, aha, these guys are foreign agents, outside agitators, we're going to lock them up, and they can get their own people riled up against them, because these aren't Iranians, these are Yankee agents.
those people are asking for our support. And that scenario that you're painting there greatly underestimates the fact that there are lots of people overseas who like America. It's been painted in the liberal press as if there's a groundswell of support against America all over the world. This is true in many places, but it's not a groundswell, and it's certainly not universal. These people are asking for our support. And they're asking for our support for a reason. And if we really recognize, look, there's a double problem here. On the one hand, we're invading Iraq, being told by some of the neoconservatives that the Iraqis will greet our troops, you know, by throwing flowers on us because they love us. And on the other hand, they say, don't support the Iranians because the Iranians don't like us. And, you know, and if we support opposition groups, then they'll be seen as agents of the Yankees and be hated in Iran. And in fact, it appears to me to be just about the opposite. The Iranians like us. And some Iraqis like us, but certainly not all of them. So I don't think that that would happen in Iran.
Well, and isn't there also a problem as far as the Iraqis is the Iraqis may not have liked Saddam Hussein, but there's just a certain natural resentment, whereas if you do something nice for somebody, sometimes they resent you for it. And
sure.
And isn't that part of what they have in Iraq? Well, they're kind of got to be kind of irritated that they couldn't get rid of Saddam Hussein on their own.
Well, then they ought to be irritated with themselves. And this is another reason
I'm not saying that they shouldn't be irritated.
Sure,
I agree
sure.
with that. I'm just asking about, I'm not saying what they should, how they should
sure.
feel. I'm asking about how they do feel.
And the answer is that we have to stop caring about what they feel. Because the purpose of the war is not to do something so that they will feel good. The purpose of the war is to protect our country so that one of our cities doesn't get nuked. Because that's what's coming if we don't end this. I mean, there is mass death coming in America if this is not ended.
Isn't this ultimately a problem, though, because Iran is trying to get a nuclear bomb,
yes.
and it's so rational for them to want one. I mean, just think in terms of their government, is that respect comes with nuclear weapons, right? People wrung their hands when Pakistan developed its nuclear weapons, saying, oh, India and Pakistan, you shouldn't have nuclear weapons. But as soon as 9/11 came around, suddenly we realized we had bigger fish to fry, and it's, okay, you guys are in the nuclear club, and that carries a lot of clout. Isn't Iran totally rational to want to have this clout?
I don't think rationality applies to a theocracy like this that has rejected reason at its very root. The Khomeini government was established. Khomeini said right out that Western reason was his enemy. There is nothing rational about this. What they want to do is, at best, become a regional power so that they can negotiate equally with the United States and start making demands. There's nothing rational about them wanting to do this so that they can maintain a medieval theocracy.
Well, one thing is that they're completely irrational. Okay,
yes.
Then there's no point in negotiating. We can't even threaten them. We just have to destroy them.
That's what I think.
Okay.
I don't think there's any point in negotiating with them.
Okay.
I think that let's put it this way. They came to power when they took over a U.S. embassy in an act of war. It was unprecedented. They declared war on us when they took over the embassy in 1979. Any negotiation we make with them from this point on legitimates that action.
By the way, one thing about taking over that embassy, our embassies are guarded by Marines, right?
Yes.
Did our Marines not put up a fight when they took over the embassy?
Well, I don't know exactly what happened there, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if they were told not to shoot back by the government. But I don't know that. I'd rather not answer that question because I don't know.
Yeah,
that's always
puzzled me because we always...
But remember, we've had lots of cases where soldiers have been told to stand guard without any bullets in their guns. The problem is not the U.S. military. The problem is the politicians telling the military they can't do their job.
Okay. Let me also ask you about that third prong. We've been talking about two prongs of the axis of evil, Iraq and Iran. But what about North Korea? What should we do about North Korea?
Well, first off, North Korea, we should recognize where the problem came from. The problem came from a failure of the Truman and Eisenhower administrations in particular to win the conflict. We negotiated an armistice with them. We actually negotiated a ceasefire in the war. Remember that the Korean War, as far as the North Koreans are concerned, and according to international standards, is a war that still goes on. We're just in a ceasefire period. So we refused up front to actually win the war and instead negotiated an end to it. And this was at a time when the Soviet Union had no capacity to strike the United States. So this all began with American appeasement, American negotiation, and American unwillingness to win the war. It's actually the first war we actually lost, I think.
I thought that was the War of 1812.
America existed as a nation and controlled its territory after 1812.
This is certainly true.
I mean, this is, and on the other hand, I could say, no, we haven't lost North Korea yet. We're just about to lose it because the war still continues. We're still in the process of losing it.
Well, also,
but the point is that we have to recognize that's where it comes from. That's where the problem comes from. Now, then we have to recognize something about...
But we need to talk about the cost of this war, right? If we want to take the... If we want, like, I think Eisenhower made a peace deal in Korea because he didn't... He looked at the cost of, you know, what the war was costing us in terms of lives and thought about, you know, is it really worth, you know, is it really worth taking losses on the scale that we did in World War II to win this war? I think he decided that it wasn't. And I think the same thing could be said about, especially you're talking about invading, going after Iran, and if we want to go after it, you know, I'm sitting here saying, gee, you know, the war in Iraq has gone so poorly, why do we want to take more on right now?
Well, yeah, let me interrupt this. You make a very good point, which is actually even prior to my point of North Korea. The question has to come is, was it in our self-interest to go into North, to go into Korea at all? And the answer is that it may not have been. Perhaps we simply should have let North Korea just take over the South and say it's not our fight. And we could have stationed our forces in Japan and in areas west of Japan and simply drawn a line and said, beyond this line you will not go. So it is true. We have to decide whether it is in our interest to pursue such a war or not. In that case, Iran is clearly in our interest. Clearly. Because they are supporting the people who have actually bombed U.S. soil and done it repeatedly. It is clearly in our interest to end Iran's nuclear ambitions. You can make an argument that, that Korea wasn't, but I don't think that argument can follow for Iran.
Okay, so it may be that you're thinking that we can do a lot of this with airstrikes. Isn't it, though, quite possible that at this point that the Iranian government may have, you know, dispersed their nuclear program enough, put a lot of it underground and deep underground in bunkers and things, that would make it really hard for us
Yeah, no, that's right. But, again, let's recognize the source of that so we don't make the same mistake and then use that recognition to guide our policy. This happened because we failed to confront them in 1979. And I know there's realities now, but that doesn't mean we should repeat the same mistakes. It may be very, very difficult to do those airstrikes now. It may be that we should do it jointly with Israel and give Israel our full support in overflights. It may be that we are actually at the point now where we would have to use nuclear weapons to do it. But the point is that Iran's possession of a nuclear bomb, the possession by a medieval theocracy of these weapons, is so monstrous a possibility that I don't think any rational person can accept it.
Well, let's think about that. The communists, we existed for a long time in this Cold War where the Soviets and then the Chinese had nuclear weapons.
Uh-huh.
And we accepted that because we had this deterrent thing, and we had this doctrine of mutually assured destruction.
Yes.
The thing is, I think that we would have that somewhat asymmetrically because... And also, I want to say that even though they're a medieval theocracy, people are generally very good about compartmentalizing their irrationalities.
Sure they are.
Yeah. So people can be having these irrational theocratic beliefs, but also realize, if we drop a nuke on the United States, they're going to destroy us.
And but, so, you know, the Iranian government has said more than once that the Islamic world can survive a nuclear war. And remember something about mutually assured destruction, the mad doctrine with the Soviets? The basic fundamental premise at root is that you want to live. Now you saw nothing out of the Soviet Union akin to the suicide movements that you're seeing now. And we're seeing 3 and 4 times a week now suicide bombers in Iraq. And it's not just poor people. In fact, it's not mainly poor people who are driven to desperation. It's highly educated people. The first female suicide bomber out of Palestine that moved into Israel was a lawyer. And it is the suicide movement. The closest thing akin to it would be the kamikaze movement in Japan. Kamikaze means divine wind, I remind people. And these suicide movements are religiously based. And it is a desire for death that makes the mad doctrine completely irrelevant.
Well, does that mean that it could work with respect to the communists in North Korea, but not with respect to the Islamists in the Middle East?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. In a certain sense, that is right. I mean, I don't even know if this Kim Jong-il is really a communist. I think you're at the point right now where it's just a thug, you know, and just a deranged thug. And but still, we're at the point where this nuclear proliferation is such a terrible threat to the world that it cannot be allowed to go on, especially in someone like the Iranians. And it's just any action to end that is a proper action because the consequences are just so horrendous. Remember some things about nuclear weapons. I asked the listeners to remember. No nuclear bomb has ever failed to work when first tested. Nuclear technology is tried and proven. And if the Iranians make a bomb, they don't have to go in the desert somewhere, set it off in order to try it, and then tell us about it. They can simply make the bomb, give it to terrorists, and let them go set it off somewhere. And remember that the terrorists they'll give it to are the kind of people who would strap dynamite on their own bodies and walk into a discotheque to kill Jews. So they'll gladly take a nuclear bomb and walk it or drive it into a city somewhere and set it off and take themselves with it.
We are talking with Dr. John Lewis, who is giving a talk tomorrow night here in Irvine. The talk is called The Failure of Homeland Defense, The Lessons from History. This is 7:30 p.m. tomorrow night, Wednesday, March 23rd, at the Hyatt Regency Irvine, 17900 Jamboree Road, and the talk starts at 7:30. This is being put on by the Ayn Rand Institute, and you can go to their website, aynrand.org, that's aynrand.org, for more details about the talk. Dr. Lewis, one thing that we need, though, one thing you've talked about, taking kind of this aggressive stance, isn't it the fact that in a big world today that we need to have friends and allies, and that if we take some of these aggressive measures that you're advocating, that we won't have the support of our allies?
No, I don't think so. And there's a couple of things to answer there. The first thing is I'm not really arguing for aggression. I make a firm distinction between aggression and offense. Aggression is the starting of a war, the initiation of violence. We have not initiated this. This has been started against us.
Okay.
So I would argue, I know it's just a minor point, but I would say we need an offensive attack. Now, as to the issue of allies, not everyone should be an ally. If you were living in a neighborhood and the mafia had taken over, you know, the block that you live on, and you want to protect yourself, you don't go to the mafia for an ally, not if you want to end the problem. You know, and we should not want about half the nations in the world to even be our allies. There's no way that we should want to be allies with Syria, with the Sudan and a lot of these African and dictatorships. We shouldn't want them to be our allies.
Oh, no, that's not what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of our European allies.
Sure.
I'm thinking of, like, France and Germany and Great Britain and Italy and the great democracies of the West, some of the other great democracies that I think we really need to have those guys as our friends.
Why?
Well, because we want to have alliances with them and because I think we have a lot of common interests with them.
But we don't have a common interest if we want to protect freedom and they don't.
So you're saying that they're really, because it's not so much that we don't need friends with Syria. I agree, they're no friends.
Yeah, sure,
anymore,
sure.
But that with France and Germany, that their friendship's not worth.
Look, the first thing that I would do in Europe is I would look at the placement of U.S. troops in Europe with the same premise that I would look at all military action, which is is it in our best interest? And I think at this point here, it would probably be in our best interest to pull every American troop out of Europe and tell the European nations that if they don't want to support us, they can take care of themselves. And if we did that, I think we might find their attitude change. There's no reason that we should have tens of thousands of troops in Germany to defend Europe if Europe is not going to support us when we defend ourselves elsewhere. So I would move those troops out. It would end this overstretching of U.S. ground troops all over the world, which are placed in areas that are not areas that we need to defend for our own self-interest at the present moment, and announce to them that we're pulling those troops out and let them face on their own the enormity of what their policies are and let them understand them, you know, in that light. In a certain sense, the basic premise of the whole idea is wrong. You know, we don't need these allies. I would challenge people to say why we actually need them as military allies. They're not going to cut off trade with us because they know the powerhouse economy that the United States is and the fact that their own economies would collapse if America were removed. I would challenge the fact that we actually need them. We certainly don't need them if they are acting contrary to the aims of the war. We also distinguish means from ends. We should never try to bring somebody in as a means to accomplish something if they are opposed to the ends. And I think that pulling U.S. troops out this way and announcing that we would be pursuing our own self-interest this way, and that the only way our self-interest lies is if they're willing to defend freedom too, might face them to also recognize the growing Muslim populations in their midst and the fact that some of these people, the most motivated of them, are terrorists within their own midst. And besides the fact, there's been a change in Europe already, even with respect to Iraq. George Bush has gone over, and you know, the reception is quite a bit different than it was 2 years ago.
Okay.
Success breeds success.
All right. I need to ask one question on the announcement that I received in the email about your talk tomorrow night. Again, 7:30 p.m. Wednesday at the Hyatt Regency Irvine, and it's free. The last sentence here says, only Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism provides the moral basis for a successful military response to the threats we face today. Here's my question. I think that it's rather unlikely that whatever you think of objectivism, I think we're unlikely to become a nation of objectivists. I think it's unlikely that there's going to be some great awakening for objectivism. So does that mean that we're doomed to have a successful military response and that therefore we should pursue something else?
I think that what people need to recognize is that self-interest is the basis for proper military action, and that self-interest is a place to start in this, is a place to understand that it is not our job to tax Americans to bring freedom to foreigners, especially when those foreigners don't seem to really want it. Once that point is understood, then people should want to understand why it is that this is incompatible with altruism, which says place the interests of others over yourself. And once that happens, then people can start to examine themselves and examine their ideas and question whether you could actually, you know, run and win a war on, let's say, Christian principles of altruism.
But
in fact, you can't. It's blatantly obvious that when you're in a war, you're trying to kill the other side, not help them.
Sure, but does that mean that we're doomed? Because
no, like I don't think we're doomed. I don't think we're doomed. I think America is on a seriously wrong path. But I do think that because people compartmentize, that they can recognize that the areas of life in which they are successful are the areas in which they act in their own self-interest, their own rational self-interest. And if they can come to see that, then they can come to understand how that has to apply to more areas of their life and even areas of government. We're on a wrong path, but America is a very special, indeed, I would say, unique nation. And and America can pull itself out of this wrong path. And one good thing that I see is that through the efforts of the Ayn Rand Institute, but also through the values of the American people, that Ayn Rand's work sold some 500,000 copies last year, which is the highest they've ever sold, including in their own life.
Okay, so your talk is being presented by the Ayn Rand Institute.
Yes.
And they have a number of things. If you go to their website, which is AynRand.org, you can find they have a number of things about foreign policy that they've written. And I was pleased to have Dr. Yaron Brook was on a few months ago on this program to discuss the work of the Institute. If you go to the webpage for this program, you can hear him talk about that.
And I appreciate your giving us a hearing.
Yes. And so, anyway, we're about out of time. So I would like to thank you, Dr. Lewis, for coming on. So, again, your talk tomorrow night is The Failure of Homeland Defense, The Lessons from History. This is going to be at 7:30 p.m. tomorrow night at the Hyatt Regency here in Irvine. That's at 17,900 Jamboree Road. Here in Irvine, the parking is $5, $9 to valet park, but the talk itself is free, so carpool, guys, if you want to go to this. And in the minute that we have left, can you just try and give our listeners just a little bit, anybody who's just tuning in, a little bit of the idea of what they can expect from your talk tomorrow night?
They can expect to hear that the only way we can properly end the threats against America and return to a state of normal life, which is a life of freedom, prosperity, and happiness, is to act in our own self-interest in ending the military threats against us.
And
history supports that conclusion.
Dr. John Lewis, thank you so much for being my guest this morning.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Okay, and please stay tuned for the 3-meter band here, and let's stay tuned for more great talk and music here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Let me tell you that next week at this time, Weekly Signals will be having their 2-hour special. It will go from 8 to 10 next Tuesday morning, and they'll have their guest John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, host of Democracy Now! Amy Goodman, and the director of Progressive Democrats of America, Tim Carpenter. So thank you, Dr. Lewis. Thank you all for listening, and please stay tuned to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, proudly broadcasting from studios at the University of California, Irvine.
You're listening to 88.9 FM, KUCI Irvine. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views of KUCI or the University of California, Irvine.
Hi, this is Chancellor Ralph Cicerone, and you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
For a fresh alternative to your talk show routine, tune in to KUCI 88.9 FM for the best in local public affairs programming in Orange County. And if you're behind a computer, listen online at www.kuci.org. KUCI, commercial-free programming since 1969.
You're listening to Radio Rock and Roll 88.9 FM with Huicho Gerardo Madrigal y Margarita González every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Don't miss it.
Hey, listen, on KUCI. Hey, listen, they're black in your eye. Hey, listen, wanna's doing it right. 8 to 10 every Sunday night.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Hasper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
You're listening to the 3 meter band.
KUCI 88.9 FM.